Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I'm joined by my buddy, RotoPat, Patrick Doherty from RotoWorld, though I can't say that we do talk a ton about football. We talk about the recent vice presidential nomination from Joe Biden, Kamala Harris. Of course, discuss some of the college football news and how that's going to, you know, impact our lives, impact lives in middle America, in you know, the southern parts of the United States, and just kind of how college football is very different geopolitically here in the United States, and you know, also some of our expectations for how the football season is going to play out, right? So how the NFL season is going to play out in the era of COVID. Of course, you guys know Pat is, you know, just very funny, very charming, very likable. So great conversation, great episode, I thought. So I hope that you guys all enjoy it. Of course, please leave a rating and review on iTunes. That's always very useful and helpful. And if you subscribe to patreon.com/takecast, you, of course, support the show, you know, support more episodes happening and get some bonus episodes as well. So thank you very much for listening. And let's go ahead and get into it. All right, everyone, welcoming back in Roto Patrick, Patrick Doherty, the official. You're the man now because you are the boss of Denny Carter. And I think once you become the boss of Denny Carter, like, that makes you the face of being the man. Like, you're the face of corporate NBC now to everybody, Pat.
I mean, if no one can control Denny, as we know, that's not possible. But yeah, I've got the most important job in the industry, and going to do the best I can. We've already told him to cut out the tweeting, and he hasn't done it. So, you know, we're going to have to really get to work. I might have to move in with them, like, delete Twitter from his phone because tweet.
Yeah, no, he's got to.
But it's an important job.
He's got to stop talking about the proletariat, right? Because you can't have that. You can't have that under the corporate umbrella at NBC. So, speaking of the man and the proletariat, the first thing that I wanted to talk to you about, because I actually think you might have some reasonable takes on this, and I'm not really actually sure how I feel about this. Kamala Harris is the vice presidential candidate who's going to be running with Joe Biden. Are you disappointed? Are you fine with it? Are you excited about it? I saw a wide range of emotions on my Twitter feed after the announcement.
I was disappointed. I mean, she was near the bottom of my list, but like the initial positive thought was not Amy Klobuchar and not Pete Buttigieg. So that was good.
Pete Buttigieg was the bottom of my list. I would have actually preferred one of Donald Trump's kids over Pete Buttigieg, I think.
The true bottom of my list was Amy, I believe.
Yeah.
Just never heard a good thing. But yeah, so Kamala, man, it's like, so first off, okay, I mean, if I'm going to try to approach this from like a positive perspective, the only real positive way to spin this, and not the only, it's a very important thing, was like, if your number one priority is not to fuck up this election, which clearly that's what the priority is, I mean, this does make a lot of sense. I mean, she's clearly like the safe choice from that regard. And, you know, the Democrats are going understandably all in on like flipping the rest of the suburbs. Like, you know, that's been in progress now for 3 or 4 years. This is like yet another chess move. And like to kind of complete that transformation of like making the suburbs all of a sudden like a Democratic bastion. So if your one goal is not to screw up what you got going with the election right now, which, you know, of course is looking very good, it makes a lot of sense. You know, like Joe Biden's going to win. I mean, he's going to win. And like, it's a kind of just like a matter of how big it was. And like, when you're in this commanding of an electoral position and like, we're in such a time of crisis, you know, not just pandemic, but just, you know, the American crisis in general we have going right now.
Yeah, it's crazy everywhere.
Like you need, I was just hoping he would make a governing choice. And to me, like the clear governing choice was Elizabeth Warren. just for so many different reasons. Someone who basically understands, her and Bernie Sanders are like the two who understand like the central problem, like the heart of American politics.
Yeah, they understand what is wrong with the model of our country right now.
They do. They understand that like the corporate state has been like captured, or that the administrative state has been captured. They're kind of like the only two mainstream American politicians who like understand even the central with American democracy right now. And of course, Bernie Sanders was never going to be the choice for vice president. I know a lot of Bernie supporters. I've never forgiven Liz Warren for staying in the race in kind of a kamikaze fashion. It was unfortunate. But I'm not
one of these people at all, by the way. I want that on the record. I voted for her in the primary here. I like Bernie's policies better, but I basically felt he was like unelectable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna out myself too there. I was also a Liz Ladd. I voted for Liz. I did at the very end. I donated to Bernie.
All of them. Just never the DNC. Give it straight to the DNC. So,
I was in on Liz Warren since like 2015. Like I wanted her to run badly in 2016, and was like despondent. To me, she's just the person for this moment. I mean,
so the issue with her was she thought she could maybe win if she kind of, she did the Biden thing of drifting towards the center. And, you know, I think that she messed that up. I actually think that she would have had a chance to be both the safety candidate and the progressive candidate for the Democratic Party had she just stayed on brand.
Well, I got disturbed by Liz's candidacy too, when she got so thrown off, like, you know, when she was in favor, when they came at her for being in support of Medicare for All. Like she was like so flustered and basically like she like let that like get her so off her game and was like never really recovered from that. So that did to me, you know, maybe she wasn't as strong of a candidate as I thought the whole time, where like she got so rattled by this
right
one
yeah
thing.
Yeah,
but I to me though, she was the person for this moment in time. And I mean, we needed a true progressive, and Kamala Harris is not a true progressive. But too, it's easy to get ahead of ourselves. I mean, as much as like I want to focus on that, I mean, we're in a time of such crisis that I am sympathetic to the argument. We're like, first thing we need to do is not screw up the election and like then worry about everything else later. A lot of people do not agree with that, but I agree with that. Yeah, I'm sympathetic to the argument that we cannot screw this up. And if all you're thinking about is in terms of not screwing up the election.
So couple takes from the underground, from the proletariat. First off, I think that and also let's be clear, Joe Biden himself is not making these decisions, right? You know, like, you know,
I don't know. Sometimes I can't. I was all aboard on like barely there Joe until his final debate with Bernie, where I mean Joe was, I'm not saying he like won the debate with Bernie, but like Joe was still seeming like pretty like normal, vigorous Joe to me. And like the thing with Joe is that, you know, he's always been like this.
Right. He's like, always been a gaffe machine.
He's always been a humongous gaffe machine. And obviously though, it's like when you're Tom Brady, like you get, when you're an athlete, as you get older, you get less benefit of the doubt if you have a down year. And so when you're old and you're a gaffe machine, of course, everyone's going to think you're just like senile. I'm not sure if I totally agree with that, the narrative that Joe Biden, and I think mostly he's certainly, I mean.
I don't think he's a puppet of the DNC. I think that he's hired a team of people who are all making really good decisions for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that he's heavily relying. Yeah, I mean, the guy, listen, he's 78 years old. I mean, there's few really sharp 78-year-old, no offense to the 78-year-olds in the podcast audience. You know, sometimes you're not sharp at that age. And, yeah, it's definitely, again, I understand the wide range of opinions there.
So this is kind of where I'm at. First off, I wanted to go look up Kamala Harris' voting record on stuff before I started being like, you know, Kamala Harris is a Republican, Kamala Harris is a cop. I gotta say, I was actually pleasantly surprised to see that her voting record was further left than I would have imagined. Like she got very high. I don't know the right phrasing.
I know the term.
Here.
Yeah.
She got like very high.
It's a very liberal voting record in the Senate. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Like that's, and so that's the point, is that, you know, the NAACP, the ACLU, both of those organizations and some other organizations that I agree with their core principles all view her favorably. So, like, that was nice. That was nice to see.
I mean, the cop Kamala narrative, like, is real, of course. Like, that's, yes. like, not made up. Like, that is real. But then, like you said, you do have to also, I mean, she's been playing the long game, clearly. I mean, but for whatever reason, she decided the long game in the Senate needed to be very, yeah, the other stuff is, like, not, like.
Yeah. So, I think that from the Biden team perspective, it is, you know, Ms. Harris gives us both, you know, minority representation, right? She's a Black woman. That is, it's very important for Black women, Black people in general to be in positions of power. So I think that's great. And it also, at the same time, you know, when Donald Trump is like, you know, this is the group of people who wants to defund the police and, you know, ruin America. Like, they're gonna, like, it kind of takes the venom away from, like, the Trump campaign distributing photos of her in police uniforms.
Yeah, I mean, they're already having, like, it's been 2 or 3 days only, but I mean, they like talking on both sides of their mouth, or they can't decide if she's, like, super cop or, you know,
or,
like,
too liberal,
or, yeah, or, like, super anarchist. And gonna be a tough needle to thread. They need to commit to one or the other, and but I don't think, you know, Donald Trump, political genius. I do not.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I gotta admit, literally, actually, just this last week, we got into the relitigation of the, not the relitigation of the 2016 election, but the relitigation of, yeah, of the Nate Silver projections. Because I saw you know, friend of the show, Ben Baldwin, make the point that it's actually true. We will never know if the 30%, 60%, whatever projections were wrong, because it happened, right? And things can happen that are 1% probability, and it doesn't make the projection system that made something a 1% probability wrong. It just means the 1% thing does happen sometimes. If it's not 0%, it can happen sometimes, right? And so, but like, basically, there is this growing sense of dread amongst, you know, the I don't know, us, people in America who have brains. Yeah, that it feels as if, you know, the projections, the polls and everything have to be wrong, because this is what it looked like when Hillary was the candidate. And, you know, that election was over by 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Hillary won. It was more like 3. Sorry to fact check you.
Well, I mean, I felt it was over once the Florida stuff. Once the Florida, so the Florida stuff came out, and I was just like, "This is not good. This is all bad."
Well, you know, the models in general, though, like, obviously, I mean, there's fairly sound science between Nate's model, between, like, the Economist's model, between lots of other models that have existed, but it really is, I mean, kind of a fantasy, obviously, that where you can actually assign, like, true probabilities to an event. So, you know, like, a football game has, like, 100 variables. A presidential election, especially in a system that is, like, not a true winner-take-all system, I mean, there are millions of variables in the American electoral system for president, and it's just kind of something we use to comfort ourselves that we can, like put a percentage on it at all. But, I mean, going based on the polls, I mean, Biden is in 2016. Slightly better, but it is better. And, like, just everyone does understandably kind of PTSD, including Nate Silver, who's, like, not even...
Yeah, like seriously, like, it ruined him.
He's built in about 19 more hedges to his model this time around, and cannot stop feuding with other modelers. I don't know. Sorry if we're boring your audience that doesn't, like, zero in on, like, election modeling Twitter, but he especially cannot stop feuding with G. Elliot Morris, who runs the Economist's model. And it basically becoming, like, a full-time job for Nate to feud with this guy. And I've been mostly taking G. Elliot's side. But, you know, yeah, Nate understandably has PTSD. And, you know, the PTSD will be useful for all of us. That will make sure we stay motivated and do our job.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what's so interesting, well, I guess I don't know how many places had primaries on August 4th, but in our neighborhood, we just had primaries this last week. And and there were a lot in the United States, not just in Missouri, but a lot of progressive candidates won. Like, there were, you know, guys who've been sitting in seats for 30 years who got primary this last week. Like, I have a sense of, and by the way, I think this is going to happen on the Republican side too, where I just think a lot of people who have been lifelong politicians, I think people are so sick of the way things work that, like, people are just going to be getting primaried, and in November, like, long-standing politicians are just going to be getting booted out left and right.
No, I mean, people are generating, I mean, 2016, you know, awoke, like, a humongous swath of the populace to basically, like, the stuff, like, doesn't just happen. Like, you need to participate. You need to vote, obviously, but you need to, like, do things just beyond voting. I mean, you need to donate money. You need to go to demonstrations. You need to go to town halls. And, like, 2016 was, like, a overdue, but it was, like, a big bang moment for, like, our entire generation. And lots of people older than us, lots of people younger than us. Like, that was, like, a big bang movement. And, yeah, I mean, we're just, I mean, listen, it's 2020, and we've had one president born after the year 1946. And, like, that's not even going to change this year. But, like, yeah, it's time for some renewal. Like, it's very common throughout American history, too. It's nothing bad. But, like, it's time for a new generation. And, like, the boomers, you know, they made their point. You know, you made your point. We understand. We get it. It's now time for some. Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a trend that I feel like will not
stop. I mean, I very much hope you're right. You know, I think that the card that the Republican politicians, that the Republican strategists would be playing right now is the silent majority, right? That these people who, or that people would lie to you in, you know, that people would lie to you in polling and actually vote for.
Yeah, I mean, when that's what you're, like, you're relying on, like, oh, our voters are just skittish in the polls. I mean, you were not.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm feeling, of course, nervous about all the elections. I'm very excited to go vote. I'm very excited to see what happens. And I wonder, you know, I think that this post office stuff, I think, is going to backfire on the Republican strategists in the sense of they're just being so obvious about it that I actually think it's going to encourage more people to go to the polls. You know what I mean?
It's true. I mean, even me, I mean, it's screwing with my head. Like, you know, I'm going to have a newborn child. Like, I don't really want to go vote in person, but it's caught my attention, you know, can I really afford to vote by mail this year? And yeah, I mean, I think it's catching a lot of people's attention, and it's still going to be enormous. But I mean, the whole thing is going to backfire for so many. I mean, the main reason it's going to backfire is because there's very little evidence that, like, vote by mail is going to be, like, some huge Democratic boon. You know, in a pandemic year, it would stand to reason it's going to be a lot of elderly conservative voters who would like to vote by mail. Like, why he decided to make this an issue, you know, to weaponize voting by mail, where there's very little evidence. I mean, this could very much hurt him, and people who would want to vote for Donald Trump may not. Yeah, just going, the post office thing, man, it's just like, talk about an important institution for rural America. Like, just the post office, I mean, just why? It's just, I mean, we understand why he's doing it, because he wants to screw with voting by mail, but one of our most august American institutions, it's just such a brain dead short-termer play. It's just it's the most openly autocratic thing he's, like, ever done. I mean,
the Economist headline from last week, where it was like 91% of Americans view the post office favorably despite it losing money year over year, and it's like, yeah, no shit, people view the post office favorably. They, like, people, not only, you can view it very simply of, like, people like being able to send mail, but, like, people like their mailman, right?
Yes.
Like just who, like, I guess the only bad experience you would have is, like, going to the post office when it's very busy. But, like, even
which
that, like,
sucks.
You know what you're getting into, yeah. Though. It's not like you're going there. It's like going to the grocery store at 5 o'clock. Like, you know it's going to suck, so you're not going to hold it against the institution. It's just, like, something that is.
No, yeah, and, like, you know, in, like, our increasingly secular society, there are so few things that, like, are in every community. Like, everywhere has a post office. Like, almost everyone knows their mail, and it's, like, it's a very popular institution. It's a very necessary. It's one American institution that's, like, purely run for, like, the greater good. Like, the post office isn't supposed, I mean, it'd be nice if it made money, obviously, but it's not supposed to make money. It's supposed to deliver our mail and do all these other things. Like, it's there for us. It's not there to, like, make a profit. And again, it'd be nice if it did, clearly. But the point is that it's like our institution. It's everyone. It's in every community in the country. You can get your mail. And yeah, attacking it is a bold play.
Yeah, mail is very important. Like a lot of people, like I know, you know, a lot of us are very online, but, you know, there are people who don't have cell phones. There are people who don't have email accounts. Like there are people who literally need access to the mail. You know, like it is, it's a disaster for those people to not have access.
Well, see, I mean, all the small businesses that rely on the United States Postal, it's just like, it's something that it's involved in so many aspects of American life. It's such an important, you would think too. I mean, is this like, why? It's the most 2020 thing ever. Like, why do we have to worry about this? Like, this is another thing. Like, we just have to be done. Like, why are we worrying about the post office? The post office should be something you never have to, never, ever have to worry about.
That's such a true statement, right? Of like, yeah, why would I have ever had a set? Like, why would...
Seriously, why are we required to have opinions on the post office? Like, why do I have to have tweets about the post office? Like,
it's true. It has become, you know, it's just become like really alarmingly dystopian, basically.
And it's just on, like, everything. It's just what everyone is sick of. It's just what every, like, this, like, having to have every last thing be some battleground. And just, you know, I think even, we know that a majority of Americans are sick. I think even larger majorities, like, we need some peace time here, man. Like, people, we need to, like, people, like, there's too many ordinary, average American citizens that are spending way too much time. We need.
Yeah, I think that's a huge reason why, you know, a lot of people are very comfortable with Biden is they just want to go back to the first 4 years of the Obama presidency where you just chilled out, you know?
Yeah.
It just did not feel that contentious.
Yeah, anyone who's plugged in knows, I mean, there's still going to be huge, we still have humongous structural problems in America that we have to solve.
Yeah, all over.
But at least, like, again, you're not. We can focus on the actual problems, and again, not be worrying about the post. Just worrying about every last thing becoming some like weaponized culture war, and we can like maybe start actually tackling some of like these generation-defining problems.
Yeah, I think you could probably sign most people up for that. They'd just be like, yeah, I'm in. I'm in to not sweat this out all that much anymore. Okay. All right, this is kind of a related question. So you're a very outside observer in this world, as an outside observer, because I'm always wondering about these opinions. You know, right now, how are you perceiving Bitcoin, you know, cryptocurrency, things like this? Does it permeate your bubble right now?
Not really. I mean, I have a few friends. Like, I have one friend who's almost his entire wealth is invested in Tesla stock and has been for like years, which is not the same thing. Like, it's, you know, it's kind of like Bitcoin adjacent, I feel like. Again,
no,
not even close to the same thing.
But no, yeah. No. But people who are like really into one of those things, like there's a big Venn diagram
tends
of
to be an
being
overlap.
Into the other thing. Yeah.
And yeah, I can't speak intelligently on Bitcoin at all. Like, I truly can't. So like my opinion is actually worthless. But just my uneducated opinion on Bitcoin, it's, you know, it's spun as like some great like democratizing force, but my fear is that just like every other thing that begins with like utopian intents is that it'll just somehow end up making it easier for people like Peter Thiel and where you can live and like never pay taxes and like do bad, or, you know, somehow make it easier for Facebook to like avoid paying. My opinion is
actually, well, your opinion is
perception.
Your opinion is not worthless because oftentimes in things like Bitcoin, it is the popular opinion that ends up like dealing with like the legislative outcomes, you know. So I would say actually that the opinion is valuable. What's interesting is that your concern from the outside is the same as my concern from someone who is closer to it, which is that it does actually make it easier for Peter Thiel or Jeff Bezos or whoever to buy an island and to, you know, get slave labor, because the whole central conceit of Bitcoin is basically like you own your money and your money doesn't decay in value over time. And so like theoretically these people who are, loading up on Bitcoin now. If it ever does end up becoming this big dominant thing, it's just going to be like this libertarian hellscape where Jeff Bezos owns us.
Yeah. If I was to reduce it to two, my concern would be to two words would be libertarian
hellscape. Yeah, libertarian hellscape is just in general like a big concern of mine.
Yeah.
Across the world. So. Yeah. And, you know, it is kind of this interesting thing where some people have looked at the current political climate and been radicalized in the liberal direction where they have been like, look, it's terrible that all these people are starving. It's terrible that all these people are unemployed. Our government doesn't care. And then there's been people who've been radicalized in the other direction of like, all politicians are corrupt, liberal and conservative. The government prints money with impunity. We should just do away with the federal government. The federal government is completely broken, which is, you know, the libertarian hellscape. And, you know, I don't know. I think that is, the ramifications of this. I don't know if the people who have made the decisions to lead us here have really thought about those ramifications.
No, it's true. I've noticed a very alarming rise in that sentiment too. Where again, I mean, I can't come close to pretending like the Democratic Party is like a great
perfect
vessel,
yeah,
for like progressive ideas. I can't even pretend it's like, I mean, I guess it's maybe good. So I understand like the Democratic Party, why so many people are so heavily critical, why so many liberal people are so heavily critical of the Democratic Party. But I mean, the reality is it is a two-party system. And it is, I mean, it's bad that it is, but like, it's, as we know, it's not even a debate, like which party is the better of these two parties that we're stuck with right now. And, you know, there's been a very concerning rise of people to just like kind of withdrawing from the system altogether. And, it's not a good way to approach this. And like, it's most politicians, I guess, are corrupt, but not all of them are. And there are fewer corrupt politicians on one side than the other. And it does alarm me how many people I see kind of like, just like people I know in like my, you know, daily life on like Facebook and like Twitter, just kind of like openly announcing that they're withdrawing from like the political process. And, it's kind of like, I feel like an underreported current political hellscape.
Yeah, the political hellscape, and it is. I mean, hellscape at this point is like somehow an overused word in the, look, you know,
yeah.
richest country on earth. And it is, it's just things are, you know, things are so broken here that hellscape is like a trope, which is insane.
Yeah, you wish it wouldn't. There would be better tropes, wouldn't there, that you'd want for your country.
You really would. So you know, more hellscape chatter. What's happening with college football? Yeah, as one does. More hellscape chatter. I mean, are you actually reverse hellscape? Your life is probably better without having to deal with Missouri college football.
True. That is, although I like I do like Coach Drink. I'll say that Barry Odom is from Missouri. Eli Drinkwitz is not, but you know, I'm a very Midwestern person. I like how Midwestern Eli Drinkwitz seems, while also seeming to be cutthroat enough to compete in the SEC. I do like what I've seen from Coach Drink. College football, what? I mean, the problem for college football, of course, is that the risk, quote unquote, is not being an athlete, although there is a big risk of being an athlete in coronavirus. Like, the risk comes from being a student. You know, like so many of these colleges are going to do online only classes. And like, if you're doing online only classes, how can you possibly say like athletes should be like an accepted class? You know, like, why are we going online? But then our quote unquote amateur athletes, you know, have to come to campus and do it. So that is really like the huge difference between the NFL and colleges coronavirus conundrum is like, even for the NCAA, like that's kind of like a bridge too far of hypocrisy. And why basically I feel like eventually every conference is going to be canceled and it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, the Big 12, literally as you and I are doing this, the Big 12 says yesterday, like game on. And I don't.
I mean, it just seems, I mean, whatever. I mean, I understand they're going to try to stick it out. I mean, you don't have to say it's canceled today too. I mean, maybe you don't really gain anything. I get you probably. I just think you can't tell students that we're going to do online classes and then, the amateur athletes have to come to campus. Like, there's just a huge, too big of a disconnect there, even for the NCAA.
So I it's kind of interesting that they could save, they could solve this forever by just admitting that the athletes are employees, right?
Good. Yep.
Like we could bubble up, you know, we could get these guys staying in hotels. We could keep them safe. We could get the testing. Now, obviously, you know, probably, you know, Kentucky probably can't afford this, but Alabama, LSU, Georgia, and Auburn can afford it, and Texas can afford it, and Oklahoma can afford it. You know, we could do like a year of like Super League or whatever, you know, they'll never do it. It'll never happen.
But this might be what, you know, like the final reckoning kind of, like, you know, finally spurs like the change that, you know, probably is an inevitability in college, and like, you know, some changing of the structure. Like coronavirus is probably going to do that. Or like a lot of like the coronavirus problems are really just existing problems that coronavirus.
Yeah, it exposes like the cracks.
I wouldn't be surprised if this was kind of like the last stand of this model, and within like two or three years, we finally have like major structural change. And which it's again, I'm not even like it's not even. I love college football. You know, like it's like been a huge part of my life.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Like, it's amazing. Everything about it, like, I love, like, the tribalness of college football. It's like a good tribalness. So it's not like I want college football to die, but I just think it will die if it continues down this path, because it's just not tenable. Like, the disconnect is too big. And yeah, I think maybe the coronavirus will be what finally kind of brings college football into the 21st century with some new.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope that we get some sort of amateurism reform, and these kids get, you know, taken care of, and that it doesn't end up being this big terrible thing where we don't get it for forever. Like, that would really bum me out.
Yeah, but hopefully it doesn't become like the video games. All I can say, it's been bad enough not having the video game. Not having the actual game would be
not having the actual game, not having the video game, not what we want. Not what we want. So as it relates to the NFL, you know, we've seen this thing go on in baseball right now. We're like, you're St. Louis Cardinals, buddy. How many games do you think the Cardinals end up playing?
My plague team, my dear plague team. I think they'll make it to 50 maybe. MLB, they're pot committed at this point to the season, aren't they? And knock on wood, hopefully it's the Cardinals' only outbreak. I don't know. I'm reasonably optimistic. That's based on probably not reality.
What's it like rooting for the plague team?
It's been a bummer because I'm like a normal St. Louisan. I'm like a normal St. Louisan where I'm like dyed in the wool, like true born and bred Cardinals fan. It's been like every day of every one of my summers since I've been like sentient. I'm still enjoying baseball. It's like, it just sucks to not have, for me, baseball is always two anchors now. It's the Cardinals and it's my fantasy teams. And I'm getting reasonably into my fantasy teams, but like I'm watching way less baseball without my team, you know? And it's just like, this is even weirder, you know, like as sports fanatics, you know, like so much of like my internal calendar, you know, like August, I'm like, oh, August, you know, the Tour de France will be ending. August, the US Open will be beginning. August, this training camp. Like so much of that has already been wrecked this year. But then to have baseball come back and then somehow not involve my team is like just an extra weirdness layer.
Yeah. I mean, it's been cool to have baseball back on TV. It's been cool to have the NHL playoffs on TV. It's been cool to see some good golf. We got a major championship. But doesn't it all kind of feel like the four course appetizer, amuse-bouche to the NFL season finding a way to kick off?
It does. I mean, it's the great colossus, you know, it will find a way to subsume every other sport as it always does. And, you know, hopefully with less of a haunted mansion feel of some of the, like baseball, you know, turn on a baseball game and it is like it's a very bizarre, it's like basically you're like having a dream about a baseball game more than an actual baseball game. But I don't know if the NFL will be able to avoid that either, but yeah, I mean, it does. Yeah. It's not great for the other leagues that, the NFL regular season is a coming, because even with, you know, it's way more competition than the NFL is used to, obviously. But we all know like a random Thursday night get higher ratings than probably even like an NBA final.
Yes. So. Yeah. Jags Titans beats Lakers Bucks game 7.
Well, it wouldn't be to game 7. It would not be to game 7. I will say, but it would be like game 1, maybe not even game. It would be a few games, I feel like, It would not be game seven, actually, though.
You think? I actually don't know.
No, NBA Finals game seven, that's usually over like 20. That would soundly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I will certainly be watching. I think that the hockey playoffs are going to, it's going to be a tough scene. Golf is going to be a tough scene.
Golf's going to be the toughest scene, probably.
Yeah, we're going to get the Masters, obviously, and the Masters will be huge, and people will be very thankful for it. But the U.S. Open, I don't even know when it is. The U.S. Open is going to be a tough scene.
Yeah, I forget. And so, like, the tennis U.S. Open, it's going to be a tough scene for U.S. Opens in general.
Okay, the U.S. Open golf, oh, man. It's like week two, week three, Thursday, September 17th to Sunday, September 20th. It's going to, that's like, well, I mean, you know, T's and P's to Brooks Koepka, who no one will even remember who he is by then. So it'll be fine when he sucks.
A real quick pointless golf aside is, why did they ever move the PGA Championship to May? It just felt so right having it back in August, and it should remain.
Yeah. What do you think about the course they played it on? Like, do you like it just being like a very nondescript, you know, like average municipal course?
Yeah, I thought that was a cool show. First of all, I have very like limited golf opinions, but yeah, I thought it was interesting to see like buildings actually, you know, as opposed to like grand oak trees. Yeah, it's cool. It was cool. I don't have any strong. I mean, golf is an elitist game. There's cool. No point in pretending otherwise, really. I mean, right. That is elite. We don't really need to. You're not fooling anybody by playing on like a municipal course.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. I mean, I think that the most interesting question is, do all 32 teams in the NFL play 16 games? What would you make the line?
I feel like I can't answer this question. I just am too much of a homer probably still, because for my job and career, relying on this. I'll just say that the challenges, the football is, so the other sports, you know, we're seeing like kind of surmounting their challenges. Like even baseball with the Marlins and Cardinals disasters, like mostly surmounting their challenges and getting this done. But, you know, first off, the number one concern with the NFL, the initial, they're still like focusing on the wrong thing. Like, why is the NFL still like focusing on schemes to have fans? You know, like they're worrying about like the wrong things. Like, to me,
yeah, we got the pods. We have separated areas in the parking lot for tailgates.
Like, this is just something the NFL needs to give up. Like, why are we spending any time on fan schemes? Because I feel like it's just gonna be mandated by either this reality or even in Texas, like local governments, that it's not gonna be. I just don't understand why so much brain power is being devoted how to get fans in, but. I mean, so the NFL, you know, by far the biggest rosters, by far the biggest staffs, 22-man full contact sport. I mean, those are problems that the other sports just don't have. And just absent a bubble, which just isn't really real. It is. So, I mean, people's confidence is understandably building as, like, the other leagues pull this off. But I do think the NFL's challenge is, like, an order of magnitude greater than, like, even baseball's with the big rosters and all the travel. Like this is going to be the hardest sport for them to keep. I still just don't know. Yeah. If I sense like enough seriousness from how, I don't know. I mean, I'm worried.
Yeah. But the Seahawks cut that cornerback though. Right.
I know. But on the other hand, you know, the NFL like never admits defeat on anything. So I feel like no matter what, they're going to just like barrel through. But, it is a concerning, it is a very,
who is the worst quarterback who is going to play as a result of COVID? Who, I think we could get so deep if like a whole quarter, like what happens if every Saints quarterback tests positive for COVID?
I just thought of actually the worst quarterback, maybe Logan Thomas will get some QB reps.
Oh my gosh. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Thomas.
I don't know who the heck, Sean Payton would probably sign like Luke McCown or something. I don't know what Sean Payton would do if he had to go down to quarterback. That's a very good question. But yeah, I feel like Logan Thomas getting some QB reps would be a very bad.
Maybe, maybe some of these coaches that have always talked about, you know, we got Josh Jacobs as our emergency quarterback. Maybe it actually gets put. Maybe it actually gets put to the test.
I mean, maybe Mo Sanu for the Patriots. We hear so much about his perfect quarterback rating. Let's put that to the test, Mo. That is a good, fascinating question. I had not thought of that. Spoiler, Denny Carter is actually going to be kind of working on an article sort of along why I just revealed that, but I think he's putting out an article about this, like about quarterbacks we may plausibly see in the NFL.
A sneaky thing is that, you know, the CFL is not going to play this year. So all those guys are eligible to play. And, you know, I think we could see some Bo Levi Mitchell, some Mike Riley, some Jeremiah Masoli. Like, I really would not be surprised if some of the Canadian guys come down.
Is every quarterback who's ever played for Hawaii getting to play in the NFL?
How old is Colt Brennan?
He's probably like 33. He's probably like my age.
He's 36. I think we could see Colt Brennan.
So Colt Brennan, that wouldn't be a bad COVID outcome. Give Colt Brennan another try. But yeah, hopefully we don't see anything too crazy. But it's definitely maybe Luke. How old is Luke McCown these days?
Okay, Luke McCown is 39, so he's younger than Josh.
I thought he was older than Josh, so yeah. Luke's very plausible.
And, you know, I mean, I think that, it would just be, I'm now rooting for Cutler. That's what I'm rooting for. I'm rooting for Jay Cutler during a pandemic going 12-for-34, 3 interceptions.
I'm trying to think of who I would actually want to see the most. Like, who got a raw deal? Like, who's the quarterback Jay's wanted to see and just, like, never got the opportunity?
Well, I guess for a while, I used to think it was Luke Falk, and then
see, maybe it's Chad Kelly.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would make preseason DFS Twitter happy, I think.
It would. That one's pretty plausible too, actually. He's still in the mix.
Yeah. So it's gonna be a year. You know, I'm hoping that the best case scenario for fantasy football is that it ends up being more like baseball, where instead of individual players are missing, it's either your team is playing or you're not. And I actually think that's probably better for fantasy football than, oh man, I got to play Javid Best this week, or Joik Bell comes back for a week. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I didn't understand why the NFL didn't build more flexibility into the schedule. Like, they should have built 2 weeks in the middle of the season that were just bye weeks, quote unquote,
to get it weeks. All sorted out.
Yeah. I don't know why. And it's weird. It's just weird. The NFL has had a lot of opportunities to build in more slack to.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm excited. You know, I'm excited for football to be back. You know, I hope that it ends up being awesome and no one gets hurt or sick and it's all good, but I have some reservations. You know, I guess the reporting we hear is that many of the teams have solutions kind of figured out. The testing seems to be going decently. I don't know. I hope we get football, Pat.
Yeah, I mean, it's been – you have to say it has been off to a good start. So,
yes.
They can't – as much as I just criticize it, yeah, I can't deny it. I think the NFL – the NFL is come hell or high water organization. Like, they're going to do this. It's just a matter of, hopefully
– week one is happening regardless of anything.
I think every week will be happening. The NFL just does not admit defeat. And I feel like they're going to forge ahead no matter what. So we'll see.
Forge forward, boys. All right, Pat, tell us about everything you guys have going on over at Roto World right now.
Yeah, well, we got a draft guide. We've invented the concept of a draft guide. So we have.
Is the magazine out?
It is. The physical magazine actually is out, and I'm the production editor of our magazine.
Beautiful. I'll probably buy it the next time I go to the store just because I like to have them.
Yeah, our magazine is out on stands, and it is being updated all the time online, and it's cheaper online this year. I don't know the details of it, which is really bad. My boss will be upset. But we have a much cheaper, easier, in-and-out model for our draft guides and season passes. It's a flat monthly rate now. But it's very affordable and much cheaper than it was in the past. We've got a really great online draft guide set up now. For whatever reason, I'm doing a non-fantasy article next week. I'm putting out an article on quarterback situations. I usually do it in May or June, but everything just got so COVID-ed this year that we got a lot of draft content coming out. I'll be putting out some final rankings. Hayden Winks, is always doing his amazing analytics. So we've got a lot of stuff going up on the site as usual.
Beautiful. All right, everyone, follow Pat on Twitter at RotoPat. Of course, keep listening to the show. Leave a rating and review if you think about it right now. We appreciate it, and we'll be back soon.